Everyone's fine. As gay men, we think we're out, we're proud, we're here. But when we look at our lives, we see the structures of shame everywhere. My family was not accepting of me being gay, and I needed to be in a place where I had my adopted family. And many of us have poured a lot of alcohol, a lot of drugs into that crack. Most of us didn't expect to live beyond about 7 years. Problem is in our language with the word love.
Shame comes in a lot of different colors and flavors.
Mine happened to have the name AIDS on it. I'm very happy to say I'm almost 40 years HIV positive.
And what role does codependence play in this effort to cope?
I'm not a big fan of using the term codependence, and I'll tell you why. I wanted to write because I felt like I had something important to say. What have we done to sex?
At the end of the day, it all comes down to finding joy.
That's the best sex of our lives. When we're drinking or drugging, those things are so loud. For certain substances, you take them and boom, the shame is off. The goal of this life is not happiness. It is contentment. And let me say something. If you are not happy with today, I guarantee you, you will not be happy with tomorrow.
Labeled a slow learner.
I always felt a little bit
different. Felt like there was something wrong with me.
I was so embarrassed. Wasn't ready to see myself.
I can't go any lower.
Don't sell yourself short.
Uncovering all those feelings.
Everything was lifted at that moment.
This really wasn't about not drinking.
Welcome to Crosstalk, the greatest podcast for living life in a balanced way. We tend to focus on alcohol and drug recovery, but today we're not doing that. We're going to be talking about alcohol and drug recovery just incidentally as it relates to living life in a balanced way. And I have an amazing guest with us today. I'm going to tell you a little bit, and I don't want to kind of give short thrift to the whole person, but one of the amazing things that Alan Downs has done is he wrote a book years ago called The Velvet Rage. This is what it looks like. And I want to read to you what somebody who's in the first page said about this book, which I like it. And I want it to guide where we go as we start our interview with Alan today. This isn't just a social commentary or self-help book aimed at a minority population. Every reader will learn a journey through cultural values about human flaws and perfection to arrive at a place where real and authentic human hope may be found. The reason I read that is because hope is the word I want to key in on. If you're watching Crosstalk today, what I want you to be able to do is see that there's hope. Hope for everybody, because everybody has little things and dings. Sometimes they're big things that need major work. Other times they're little adjustments. Everybody's got them. Everybody needs to get their car in the shop every once in a while. And hope sometimes is elusive. It is not that easy to find. The focus of Velvet Rage is about gay men and the journey that gay men have in their emotional lives. Alan in the book talks about shame, the shame of growing up, being different than many of the people that are around, coping mechanisms that are used or misused to try to get one's balance, and how you kind of come out the other side of that. Each of our personal journeys are different, and Alan will talk a little bit about his own journey and advice that he has for you during our interview. And I'm really excited to have Alan here. Alan spends a great deal of his time helping other people as a therapist, but I call him a friend, and I'm so excited to welcome Alan Downs to Crosstalk.
Thank you, Corey, and it's great to be a friend.
Thanks for being here.
Yeah.
So, Alan, I want you are one of the few guests that we've had that doesn't come to tell their journey of recovery from substance use disorder to sobriety.
Right. But from substance being the key aspect, because much of my life, and the Velvet Rage is about our journey out of shame. For so many of us, and for me, it happened to be the shame of being gay and growing up in a small town in the South, in a very fundamentalist environment where it was, well, God hated fags, was what we were told. And we had a secret we had to hide, which made us different. And it really was a crack that was put into our soul that we had to learn to live with as adult men. And many of us have poured a lot of alcohol, a lot of drugs into that crack. But there are other things that we've done. And I've certainly had my journey through struggling with what that is and how shame affects our lives in a very insidious way. It's one of those things that once it gets in, it becomes part of the architecture of who we are. We don't think we're ashamed. We think we're out. As gay men, we think we're out, we're proud, we're here. But when we look at our lives, we see the structures of shame everywhere. Let me kind of jump in just to say, think about the gay men that you've known. And in every profession that we have that is creative, you will find a gay man who is at the top of that profession somewhere, or gay men. We are beautiful at creating a lovely facade over an ugly truth, the ugly truth of our shame, of that secret that we as young boys had to hold and hide from the rest of the world that set us apart and really was the journey of recovery for us as gay men, coming to terms with that brokenness and realizing that it was the brokenness that is the door to vulnerability and to our power in life.
Now, I just want to make sure that I'm getting the connection between the journey you're talking about with for yourself and for gay men, and also shame in other forms.
Right.
Shame of being adopted.
Right.
Shame of having been abused.
Yes.
Shame comes in a lot of different colors.
Yes.
And flavors.
Well, let's talk about shame, because that's important. Shame is not necessarily a bad thing. That may surprise you to hear. It's an emotion that nature gave us to fit in. If you think about our emotional system, it's like the idiot lights on a car. You and I are old enough to remember cars when they just had that light that would come on that says, stop, engine's on fire, or, you know, immediately. Didn't tell you what was wrong. We didn't have the computers in those days, but we had just a light that would say stop. Your emotional system is that antiquated, and it is operating in the same way. And when shame fires up, when that siren goes off and the lights come on, it's because you're not fitting in. You need to fit in to survive. As a young man, let me put it this way. If you had a dog that had a litter, and you had to keep that litter for 18 years before you could let those puppies go out on their own, you'd never have a litter of puppies. That would be just, for most of us, it would be impossible.
Right.
Well, for a young boy, you have to be cared for 18 years before you can go out on your own and survive in this world. And so nature gives us this alarm system that says, you're not fitting in. You must fit in if you're going to survive. You have to be taken care of. People have to like you. Your parents have to like you in order to be able to survive. To not fit in is akin to death. And when we're young adolescent boys, that becomes so, so clear that we have to fit in. We have to sit at the popular table, if you will. We have to be liked. And not to is death.
And the shame comes when we don't want to do that and we're not able to do that.
When we're not fitting in, shame is firing. And so for most of us who are gay, we grew up maybe not knowing we were gay, but we knew we were different. And most of the kids around us knew that we were different. And we had to hide that secret in order to fit in. And we did whatever we could to fit in and to appear as if we were like the other boys. But we knew deep inside that we had that secret, and that was to be protected at all costs. Because if it were out, we would be rejected. And we would that would be akin to death.
So at all costs leads to coping mechanisms.
Right. Right. Well, it leads to coping. I wouldn't say necessarily it's always effective. But we find ways in order to silence the siren of shame. Substances are really powerful. It's like a light switch. For certain substances, you take them and boom, the shame is off. Whew. There's relief. And you go down almost any substance, alcohol, crystal meth, marijuana, any of the ones that we see among gay men, most of them, that's what they do. is they'll turn off shame and they'll do other things, which are beneficial. And I use that word very loosely because there is a side effect to each one of them, and it is deadly, unfortunately. But there are ways in which we can try to silence that shame that are not so effective. Compulsive sexuality in relationships that are really more compulsive than they are about joy and love that we experience. We overachieve. Many of us found we could get validation academically or otherwise, and so we went to the top of our profession, and that became what we did. Love me. Let me dance on this table. What dance do you want me to do?
And what role does codependence play in this effort to cope?
Well, let me say this, and I know this, some folks will disagree with me, but I'm not a big fan of using the term codependence, and I'll tell you why.
Sure.
It's become so broadly defined that it sometimes isn't useful for us, because in a healthy relationship, there is always an element of codependence that is healthy. It's not all bad. But what happens often is we will use another person, as it were, a drug, to try to turn the shame off. So if I am feeling less than, and I go into a relationship with you, I get from you what I feel less than about. And I use that to try to cope through life.
It's a validating tool.
Yeah. Yeah. And I become dependent upon the relationship, which changes everything, and it's rarely effective for us as individuals and adults.
And why is that?
Well, because we're not able to. It's about escape, and it's about relief of the shame. It's not about joy and passion in life. That becomes kind of a silly word to most of us. We're so busy running from the shame that to say, what brings you joy? Most gay men, I'll tell you, can't answer that question. We can tell what brings us pleasure, physical pleasure, but we can't tell you what brings joy, because we spent our life running from rather than running toward. Joy is what we run toward. It is our North Star. It is what guides us. It is what's implanted inside of us by the universe, God, whatever higher power you want to call. It is that message that says, that's the way to go. That's the direction.
And having read The Velvet Rage, what's raging in my head is the fact that in order to be able to find the North Star of joy, of passion, one needs to first be oneself. One's authentic self, instead of all of this noise, trying to...
But when you've been running all your life, you don't know who you are. You don't know the authentic self. It's a shell that's empty inside. Because, let me say this, as an adolescent boy, it's necessary that we screw up. We have to run around, be irresponsible, try things, see if it fits, and be free to do that. And when you're running, trying to silence the shame, you can't experiment in life. You don't get to know who you are. You know what brings validation, what brings the approval of others, but you don't know what is in here.
Right.
And so what we have to do is that period of adolescence, the window comes to a close. You know, let me say this. If you learn a foreign language, when you're young, you can usually pick it up pretty quickly and be quite fluent in it. Now, you can do that as an adult, but you will never be as fluent with that language as if you had learned it when you were younger. There's a window of time in which we can learn the self, and it comes to a close. And when it does, we become adults that don't know who our authentic self is, because it's never been allowed to develop. So what has to happen in our lives is a second adolescence, where we experiment. We run around like teenagers, trying to figure out who we are and trying on various costumes and activities in life, places, reaching, trying to discover who we are. And we can do it, but sometimes we're never quite as fluent with that as we would have if we had not had the issue of being ashamed when we were younger and the development of ourselves.
The two thoughts that I have is, one, I played golf as a little kid, And I know it was a lot easier for me to play golf
right.
and be good as I got older. The people that took it up when they were 30 or 40 years old were never, rarely, really. Sometimes,
you,
but rarely.
You don't want to see me play golf.
Right. That's not why I brought it up.
But I'm one of those 30-year-olds that, yeah, I'm terrible at it.
Right. But when you're young and if you start early enough, right. it's it becomes, you know, very, very natural when right. you get older. The other thing that struck me is...
Gord, can I say something?
Yeah.
As gay men, we didn't have time for golf. That we were too busy running for validation.
Mm-hmm.
We couldn't go hang out on the golf course with the guys. That was not something that really was open to us. And we were so busy trying to win the approval with other things that we could do that we never had the opportunity to develop that skill, and others often. So what you see among many gay men is that we're not necessarily fluent in the same things that the straight boys were so fluent in, because we didn't have that opportunity.
Interesting.
Yeah,
you know, when I talked with people in treatment about finding balance and having a happy life
right.
without using alcohol and drugs, I would ask the question, what are the things that make you lose track of time?
Yeah.
And the person would have struggle with that.
Yes.
And it reminded me with what you're talking about being the empty shell, wanting to know exactly what it is that turns you on, not just what's an effective tool for making everybody else happy or accept you or whatever,
right.
finding out what you really love, what you're passionate right. about.
The problem is in our language with the word love. It's been corrupted, and we misunderstand it. Love is better understood as joy in the presence of someone else or something else. And when we feel that joy, we make the judgment that we love. You know, people will come, clients will come to me and say, I don't know if I love him or if I'm in love with him. And I don't know what the hell to say to that. I don't know the answer to that. Because it is a judgment that you're making. Do I feel joy in their presence? And once we wake up one day and we decide, yeah, I really feel joy when I'm with him or her.
Hang on a second.
I say I love him.
Is this good shit or what? I mean, that's brilliant stuff. You know, you seem to be a smart guy. You're doing very well. I really love what you just said.
Yeah, it is, well, like both of us, we were both married to women when we were younger, right? And we were both sincere about it, and we both loved our wives, and they were wonderful human beings who, at least in my case, had no idea that she was marrying a gay man, nor did I at the time. But as the life went on, I came to know that about myself. And it really was a struggle, because not only was it affecting my life, it was affecting that of Karen, my ex-wife. And she didn't sign up for that. She didn't sign up to be with a gay man. Wonderful woman who had been in the Miss Louisiana pageant and very talented singer, had a great career ahead of her, was an educator, and married to a gay man, right? So we went through those struggles in life to really, we paid a price to get to know who we are. You know, interestingly enough for me, and it just so happened, as these things do, after I got divorced, I finished grad school, and found myself in San Francisco with a job with Hewlett-Packard in 1986. And it was the middle of the AIDS crisis. And that changed everything for us. Because not only were we now running from shame, we were running from death. When you would see someone at the gym and they were no longer showing up anymore, you didn't ask. You knew. I remember sitting in the sauna with this beautiful man, beautiful body, sitting there, and we were both sitting with no clothes on, and he looked at me and he said, I hate coming in here. And I said, why? And he said, because every time I look down, I'm afraid I'll see a lesion. Because in those days, it was Kaposi's that would happen, and they'd be gone.
Lesion meaning a cut?
A Kaposi's cancer lesion, which was one of the diseases, opportunistic infections, that was taking so many during the AIDS crisis. So we had to divert our attention away from
coming out and exploring, and instead we had to survive. Most of us didn't expect to live beyond about 7 years.
You lost a lot of friends.
I buried two boyfriends. I lost more friends than any 20-year-old was equipped to do. It's hard for me to talk about it even now because, Corey, I don't mean to put down anybody's experience, but we went through Auschwitz in a way. Everyone was dying. There were men, beautiful young men, walking down the street with a cane tapping because they were blind. That was not an uncommon experience. And we all just wondered, when will tomorrow be the day? I had a partner at the time, and he was a painter. And I was working for Hewlett-Packard. I wanted to write a book. And I knew we didn't know how much time we had. And so one night, Kevin and I, my partner, were in bed. And I said, I want to write. And he said, well, quit your job and let's write. And I'll paint. And we left San Francisco and we moved to the French Quarter in New Orleans. And we lived there for 2 years. My first book was published, Corporate Executions. It was very newsy. It put me on, God, everything, 60 Minutes, you name it, NBC Nightly News with Tom Brokaw and the whole thing. And I was so excited to be an author and to have an experience of living in the French Quarter. And we became something of bohemians. We lived our life. We had something nipping at our heels. We had to find out who we were because time was limited. And if we didn't do it, we might not have the opportunity. So what I want to say to you and to your audience is that HIV, as horrible as it was in many ways in my life, was a gift. It was truly a gift, and it made me come to terms with some things that, God willing, I've been able to put in my books and writing and to help others with, because we didn't have time. We had to come to terms with it. We had to figure out who that real self was and give it space to grow, because tomorrow may not be here.
You know, it's not often that I'm speechless, but this is a time where I can kind of feel almost impossible to really know, but I can feel the sensitivity and the horror that you went through, both personally and for the people that you loved, even the people you didn't know.
Right.
But to see the one by one by one, yeah, people dropping, and they did nothing other than just be themselves.
Well, their families also in those days often didn't understand and would have nothing to do with them. I volunteered at San Francisco General for a number of years in the AIDS ward. As a psychologist, I was often assigned to sit with someone who was dying. And I've sat beside, I don't know how many men that we lost. Lovely, important men. One, and I'm not going to say his name because I don't want to disrespect his memory, but he was a well-known porn star at the time. And he was dying, and he was brilliant. He spoke 7 languages, and his was a loving, wonderful guy who happened to be quite talented in the porn area, but his family would have nothing to do with him when it came to the end. And there was a group of us that sat with him and held his hand while he made that journey. There are times, even now, that I wake up at night and a face comes in front of me and I remember. And if anything, for me personally, that's what drives me. They didn't get a chance. And I want every gay man that I work with to be able to have a chance to get to know who they are before time's up. You know, Corey, one of the things I say often when I speak, and I want to say this as powerfully as I know how, everyone that you love and that loves you will at some point leave you. That's the way life is. We are born alone and we will die alone. When they're next to you, tell them you love them. Pull them close. Because that's the lesson really of AIDS. We didn't have time to fool around. We had to get to it.
It's interesting how the your life has been impacted in a positive way by something so horrible.
Yeah.
By accelerating the process of just doing what you want to do.
Corey, is that any different than what's happened with you in your life? Mine happened to have the name AIDS on it. I'm, by the way, and I'm very happy to say, I'm almost 40 years HIV positive and healthy and living life and having everything in life that I could ever want. You know, I'm lucky.
We had a guest here recently who wrote a book. It was, and the postscript of the book, his name is Mitch Motivates. Mm. And it says, my addiction, my superpower. And I think that's the connection that you were just referring to.
Yeah.
The best thing that ever happened to me is that I discovered the fact that I have a disease.
Yeah.
And that disease has allowed me to learn things
yes.
that I never would have learned before.
Yes.
I would have been a happy idiot. I think that's a song, isn't it? Struggle for the Legal Tender, Jackson Brown, The Pretender.
I think
it's called The Pretender. It's funny. That's the song that I think of.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, and what's the Leonard Cohen quote that we're going to put on the site? So I want this is the best quote.
Everything is cracked. That's how the light gets in.
And that's what we're really talking about.
This is our light. This is, I don't hold a lot of spiritual beliefs, but I'll tell you two that have guided my life. One is, every face I meet is another face of God. Treat it that way with respect and with honor and with compassion, right? Every single one. And we're all broken. That's a gift from God. Because what we learn in this life is recovery, which is that our brokenness is our superpower. It is the thing, it is the key to the truth within us that makes life worth living.
I think I would add to that is if you pay attention,
right?
You know, and you take action, it's very easy to fold.
Right.
And many people fold and they don't get the opportunity.
Well, you want to live in hell, you may do it in this life right here, right now. And you want to live in heaven, you can have that right here and right now. We don't need to look to another life for that. I guarantee you, I've seen both. And it's a choice we make, how we spend our time and how we live our lives. It is a choice.
So today, we're here in New York City.
Yeah.
It's Pride Month in our country and around the world.
Right.
And you're going to be speaking to a keynote speaker to an audience tomorrow.
Right.
Of men, primarily men.
Sober men. And those that are not.
And anybody else who's interested in hearing you speak. You want to talk maybe a little bit? This is going to air after that, so
right.
You're not going to kill, you know, the surprise factor. Can you talk a little bit about, you know?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, the message I want to bring and that is on my mind of late is that the goal of this life is not happiness. It is contentment. And let me say something. If you are not happy with today, I guarantee you, you will not be happy with tomorrow. Let me explain that. We have a set point. We have a baseline of pleasure. And we may think that we're working for a better tomorrow, but what will happen is when tomorrow comes, that baseline resets. And we're as unhappy with tomorrow as we are with today. I can tell you, anyone that's lived any life knows this, that tomorrow will not necessarily be better. That's a myth of capitalism and modernism. Tomorrow will be different. And if you want to be joyous in tomorrow, learn how to be joyous today, where you are. We have to learn acceptance, and that's not a great American value. American individualism says, I can change anything, it doesn't matter, whatever comes my way, I will make a difference. Well, you can change tomorrow, but when it comes to today, we must accept what it is. And the truth of acceptance is, you're not going to get everything that you want in life, and it's not a catastrophe. And what you do have is enough. If anything, I learned in going through my journey, going through AIDS, going through working in a corporate environment, leaving that to become a therapist, 35 years practicing, seeing literally probably now thousands of men over the years. It's my joy. It's me.
Yeah. Well, the journey, as it were, is where that's where we are, where our feet are,
right,
is where we experience things. You know, in recovery, they talk about regretting the past, not regretting the past, right, not wishing to shut the door on it. That's a phrase from the Big, right, Book. And they have promises on page 86, right, and 87 of the Big Book. And the promises actually are, I guess, guidance as to what's to come if you take care of yourself in the moment today.
Right, right.
And for me, those promises continue. You know, you don't reach there. You don't get there. There are no goals that once you get to the point where you, right, have this much in the bank,
right,
or you have this relationship, or you know, any of these markers that we associate with success, they're just in the moment.
Right.
Because everything changes.
Those are capitalist notions. And they're not psychological. They're not contentment. Contentment is being at peace with what you have and who you are. Capitalism demands of us that we be unhappy because we need to get things, more things, in to keep the economy going. Really, what we're talking about is learning a personal philosophy that's very different than what is in the, if you will, the zeitgeist of our culture, which is learning to be at home with what you have and loving what is right now.
People, I have a home that I live in New York City. We're in my home right now. And I have a place in Florida. I like to be in a place that's warm when it's very cold here, although it's probably going to be 90 degrees in New York soon,
right,
in the wintertime. But for now, it makes sense. And I'm always asked, what do you like to be better? Do you like to be there or do you like to be here?
Yeah.
And my answer is always the same. It doesn't matter. Because wherever I am.
That's a smart man. Yes.
It's all good.
Right. Where you are, where you're sitting right now, is to be content.
Right.
Right.
So that's a real gift. It's, yeah, not the way it was every day.
Yeah. Now, you ask about the talk. That's what I'm bringing to the talk Saturday, is the importance of contentment. And I will say this, let me be explicit here. I don't want to offend your listeners, but especially among gay men, what have we done to sex? We have come up with a list. You must have this size dick, you must have this body, you must be a bottom on Tuesdays, you have to have all of these things. This is not what sex among gay men, among anybody, that's really effective. That's one of the messages I bring as well, which is we need to get back to learning to encountering each other as individuals, as men. The wonderful aspects of who you are. When two men come together, it's not about, can you fulfill my checklist? It's about, show me your truth and let me love and enjoy the beautiful brokenness that makes up Corey, that makes up who I am with in that time. That's the essence of sex. That's the best sex of our lives. It's not with the hottest guy. It's not with the guy with the muscles. It's not the guy with the big dick. It's not with the youngest guy. It's with the guy that we can connect with on that soul level.
And by the way, speaking on behalf of the straight audience that's listening, it's the same goddamn,
yes,
thing.
Yes.
Because, you know, what do you see in all the,
right,
how do you sell that? You sell that with a beautiful woman or a beautiful man.
Right.
And, you know, the connection that we're making is that's what we need.
Right.
That's not what we need. What you're saying is right.
Sexual incompatibility is not a thing. That's a construct we've made up. You only are incompatible if you choose to see it through that lens. Because really, what sexual, when we come together in a sexual bond, it is about me coming to see the full truth of you and loving that, and vice versa. The giving of pleasure and the receiving of pleasure, and it has nothing to do about whether we're both bottoms, tops, sideways, whatever it is, because when we come together, I just want to give you pleasure, however that comes. Mm-hmm. And when we limit ourselves to say, oh, I can only do it one way, we've destroyed sex. It's time for a few voices to pop up to say, wait a minute, this has gone. We're in an effort to liberate ourselves. We've gone to the place now of balkanizing, where we're all in these small groups saying, I am only this sexually.
And can the same be said for your idea of somebody you're attracted to who has a certain economic requirement?
Right.
There are all these markers.
Your pocketbook has nothing to do with the content of your character.
But, you know, there are people who will only go out and date somebody if he or she has, you know, a certain amount of stature.
That looks good on paper, right? Yeah, nothing could be more of a failed attempt. And men who have done this know this intuitively. It doesn't work. What we do is we don't bring our expectations and fantasies and say, now fulfill them. I come to you and say, show me the truth of you and let me enjoy the wonderful masculine energy that is, period.
Well, I like the fact that at the end of the day, it all comes down to finding joy with one another and with what you're doing.
Joy is our North Star. Follow it, follow it, follow it, follow it, no matter what. Follow the joy. It will always take you to the place of contentment.
And, you know, what I said earlier about losing track of time, mm-hmm. when you find those things, there are certain things that put me in a place where I could just be there forever.
Yeah.
If I'm sitting down, there are times where I'll be reading a book and I can't put the book down.
Right.
And I don't want to be any place else in the world, but and the worst thing that you could do is get to the last page. Mm-hmm. I'll find something else.
Right.
But, you know, that kind of pleasure where everything else is kind of zoned out. And
you know, when we're drinking or drugging, those things are so loud, they're so busy, that it causes us to be able to miss the simplicity that joy has for us. You know, joy doesn't behave very well. If I told you to be joyous right now, you couldn't do it, could you? All we can do is prepare ourselves and set the stage. And joy, the muse, if you will, shows up. And she's not always exactly how we would see it. But when she does show up, it is always because we're present, very present in this moment, without expectations or fantasies, but simply to embrace who she is.
Yeah, I think that's right. And we have expectations of what something is going to do for us.
Right.
Those expectations are not really met that well. The nice thing when I was drinking and drugging is using Quaaludes back in the 70s.
Right.
And Oxy 10 or so years ago, when I was on a run with that stuff, they were reliable.
Right.
It wasn't joy. But what it did for me was very reliable.
Right.
I knew exactly where it was going to put me, and I knew it was going to put me in a place that was better than where I was before I did it.
When we can't access joy, we go for pleasure. And they do bring pleasure, but they have one problem. They have a side effect that will kill you.
A modest little side effect, little footnote.
Right. We don't like to look at that. We don't like to say it. But that is the problem. They do bring benefit, if you want to call it that. But that benefit has a huge cost with it, which is death, really.
And when you're doing it, you don't realize that pulling the trigger, there will be a bullet in one of those cylinders. You don't know which one or when.
Yeah.
And when you're younger, you don't think that cylinder's ever going to come.
Right.
When you get a little bit older, and maybe a little bit wiser, even if you're not older, you realize that it really doesn't matter, because as you're doing it, you're really preventing yourself from creating any kind of life for yourself.
Right.
I don't know. I love the recovery community because we've kind of all been in a place that was hell.
Right.
We've learned from it. And, you know, it's the same thing really as what you're talking about in The Velvet Rage and what you're talking about in your talk tomorrow, which is finding a way to get back from the shame and from feeling less than stigmatized and just being yourself and being okay with being yourself and finding joy. That's what the recovery process is also.
Right. That's the process of this life. It's for us to be able to find that brokenness and find the joy that is on the other side of it.
So in your own life right now, what do things look like right now? I know you're living in California.
Right.
And you're seeing patients.
Yes.
Now, I know very well that you're an amazing therapist and that you also probably are charging a quarter of what you should be charging people when you see them. And that's because you want to help as many people as possible. So you do that. Most of it is online, a Zoom kind of thing.
Yes. For years, I had an office. Most recently, had an office in Beverly Hills for a decade and a half or so, where I saw clients in person. And the move to Palm Springs for me was, this was about Alan. I needed a smaller village. I needed a place where I felt at home. As I may have mentioned, I think when we spoke earlier, Corey, that my family was not accepting of me being gay. And I needed to be in a place where I had my adopted family, where I surrounded myself with love and people who cared. And that was Palm Springs. That's in Palm Springs. Palm Springs is a gayville. Our entire city council is gay. Our mayor is gay. It's estimated that 75% of the population of Palm Springs is gay. So we're gay. And it's okay. And I have my garden, and I have my little enclave where I live, and I love it. And honestly, I don't leave it that often. You were one of the reasons why I left this time to come to New York. And I do it maybe a couple times a year, but not much more than that, because I'm content there. And so what that did to my practice is it all went virtual. I do not maintain a physical office anymore, and I see everyone online. And as a result, I don't see severe mental illness like I did for years. I think that's more appropriate for an in-person therapist. Really, what I see, which is often termed as coaching, are those who are struggling in life with everyday problems of finding joy and finding themselves. And that's where my heart is, and that's what I love doing.
And I know for a fact, both for years, I've known how talented you are. And one of the great talents that you have is writing. I know you're working on something new.
Yes, yes.
Can this kind of be like a spoiler alert of sorts to everybody?
I'm not going to give you too much about what I'll tell you why. As soon as I say this is what the next book absolutely will be about, I've already rewritten it in my mind to something else. But I will say this. We've had a number of kind of interests and detours through television series development of possible ideas. And right now, even the possibility of putting something on the stage. And that's had me writing in different areas and holding back on the next book. There is another book. I don't want to sound too pious with this, but I didn't want to write at this point in my career because I had an audience. And I'm very fortunate to have a worldwide audience that is very loyal to my writing. I wanted to write because I felt like I had something important to say. And it's not until right now, in this time in my life, where I feel like I'm pregnant with that idea that I'd love to be able to put in book form and share it with my readers. So that will happen. That will be given the lead time of publishing, that will be within the next year and a half.
That's great. So it'll be will this be the second in a series, or will it be a completely new?
Right now, the title that we're working with is Beyond the Velvet Rage.
Okay.
And I'll just leave it at that.
Okay. Yeah. Very good. I'm excited to read it.
Thank you. Thank you.
Anything that comes out of that, you know, it's not that, your head is not that big, but there's a lot inside of there.
Well, sometimes we all have our ego.
Yeah, yeah.
And I certainly have my moments, but I spend a lot of time in quiet, and I spend a lot of time in meditation. Yesterday, I was in Westport, and a wonderful group there, Westport Pride, had me and sponsored me. And I spent the afternoon sitting in a lovely Episcopal church on the green, St. Paul's on the green. It was empty. I walked in the door. It's my favorite thing to do. I'm hoping to be able to go in and to see St. John the Divine while I'm here. I understand they've lit it in with the colors of the gay flag, which is important to me. But what's even more important is just the architecture that says there's something more important in this world than me. There's something else that I need to turn my attention upward. I don't have the answers to what that is. I was so traumatized by the religion of my childhood that to get close to anything that's organized religion for me is tough. But it doesn't mean that I don't know that there's something that I don't understand, that's larger than I am, that is in the world, that seems to be looking after our highest good. And whatever that is, I like to sit in its presence and just meditate. That makes me really, I think that's been the thing that makes me the most content.
I know when periodically, when I travel out to California, we meet in LA and we have dinner, or in Palm Springs or in New York City. I remember you telling me that you often are speaking sometimes in churches, and it's not something that's a one-off type of thing in Westport.
Right. Well, interestingly enough, as I was walking up here to your place in New York City on, I guess I could say 58th Street, across the street is the Unity Center.
Yeah.
I did not realize that. I gave the sermon there 10 years ago. They had me come for the Velvet Rage, and there was, I don't think it exists anymore, but there was the Unity Center at the on the west side. It was where the it's quite large West Side Symphony, I think, was the auditorium, spoke there. So there are those accepting, affirming churches that I sometimes speak in, and I enjoy that. Yeah.
So I have a question for you that if I remember, we try to ask guests that we interview as a kind of a, when we're getting towards wrapping up an interview. I think your answer to the question, first of all, it's not going to be that hard for you to answer. There are people that like this, but the question is, if you had the opportunity to speak to young Alan, pick the age, 10, 11, 12, whatever age you might think appropriate, knowing what you know now, what advice or what words of wisdom would you give young Alan if you had that opportunity?
Live your life knowing that the end of the story is wonderful.
Knowing, meaning believing and being
the story,
assured,
when it ends, will be wonderful. I think if I, for years, I ran scared, worried that AIDS would take me, that there would be, I would be rejected by others. In fact, I, for years, didn't come out as a gay psychologist for fear that I would lose my practice of sorts, or that I would only see gay men and I would no longer see women and children, which I don't see children anymore, but I was really quite concerned with that. But you know what? I realized the ending of the story is good. You don't have to worry about that so much.
You know, it's interesting that how things have changed over our lifetimes. Yes. I'm a little older than you are. Not wiser, but I'm a little older than you are. And in 1982, when I got sober, I was a practicing attorney. The chances of my telling a client or a prospective client that I was an alcoholic in recovery was zero.
Right.
Because there's no chance that I would get retained by the client to be their attorney if they knew that their lawyer was a drunk. Today, when it's completely a non sequitur, if I have the opportunity, when I'm finished with whatever business we have and we start talking about our lives, it's one of the first things on, you know, that comes out of my mouth, because I believe there's an opportunity not only for the people to know who I am and for me to learn more about them, but potentially to be able to help somebody else.
Right.
Everybody's got to...
Well, those relationships are all about trust, right? And we can't trust what we don't know. And when we don't know who you really are, the full story of who you are, we can't really trust you. But once we know it and we realize that you have dealt with it, it really builds trust, I think. When people know that I'm gay and they know the struggles that I've been through in my life, I think that builds trust because they know me. It's the unknown that is the thing that really causes us to mistrust others when we can't predict who they are.
That's right. And the other part of it is that during the course of our lives, the stigma associated with all of this has been reduced, not eliminated.
It has been reduced, but let me say something. A lot of that stigma is here, not out there.
Mm-hmm.
We think that others are going to reject us because we're in recovery. But has that really happened in your life? Or has it opened a window that's brought other people into your life and other business and other partners and other things that have been really wonderful?
I think it depends. It depends on the building. I'd say most of the buildings have windows that
Corey,
they open.
If you hadn't owned your recovery, you and I wouldn't be sitting right here, and you wouldn't have hundreds of listeners listening to your podcast.
Well, thousands. I don't want to brag.
You got it, right? We wouldn't be doing this if we hadn't been able to come to terms with it and own it.
That's right. That's right.
And it opened a door for both of us that it's been wonderful, and I would never want to shut, ever.
Well, I am so grateful for your sitting in our crosstalk seat.
Thank you.
We've had some amazing guests.
You have.
Really none as enlightening to have a conversation with as you, and our listeners are better for it, and I'm better for it.
Thank you.
And the way we end these interviews is with a hug. So would you honor me?
Of course.
Sergio, you got to move that camera.
You're good.
I don't want pictures of our butts.
Not now, at least.
Oh, I love you. Thanks, Corey.